Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's been a big 24 hours at the U.S. Supreme Court with its latest weakening of affirmative action and oral arguments involving the future of television and if there's a constitutional right to lie during election campaigns. Really, Slate Supreme Court watcher Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor, is here to break down some of the details. Hey, Dahlia, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
So the Michigan case has gotten a lot of media. We will get to that. The Aereo Cloud TV case, a fair amount. I think the least coverage in the last day has gone to the oral arguments over the law that bans lying in political campaigns. So let's talk first about that. What's in that law?
It's a very, very strange case at every level. This is a case that comes up from Susan B. Anthony List, which is got nothing to do with Susan B. Anthony. It's an anti-abortion group. And in 2010, in the midst of a big election, a very heated election, the group wanted to put up billboards in Ohio that were going to accuse then-Ohio Congressman Steve Driehaus, who said he was a pro-life Democrat but had voted for the Obama health care initiative, that he, quote, supported taxpayer fund abortions by voting for the ACA, and they wanted to post these, and they wanted to do, and in fact did, run radio ads saying that. Driehaus objected. He said, hey, I didn't support taxpayer-funded abortion because it's not in the law, and the president signed an executive order saying no taxpayer money goes to abortions, so they're lying. Now, Ohio has a commission, kind of a truth commission. And the Ohio Elections Commission has a law that more or less says, and 15 other states have similar laws, that says that you can't knowingly or recklessly make false statements about candidates in an election context. And believe it or not, 15 states have such laws. Ohio's commission basically looked at Driehaus's complaint and said, you know what, we find probable cause. In other words, there's some evidence that Susan B. Anthony List is lying. And the case comes to the court because Susan B. Anthony List challenges both the law, the finding of the commissions, and says, this is a free speech case. We should be allowed to say what we want in an election without being chilled by a government entity.
So would you say it's a question of where the line is between lying and spin for this anti-abortion group? Because I know they had a rationale here, too, that even though the president signed this executive order, there are still ways that the public money leaks into funding abortions. Or is it actually about whether lying in an election campaign is a constitutional right?
Well, that's kind of one of the issues that the court danced around yesterday. That seems to be the case, that there is one issue, which is, can someone be the arbiter of what is truth and lie in the first place, or was this simply truthful? And that almost doesn't come up because the position they take is that no court, no entity can be in the position of making those kinds of determinations. It's sort of the world of what Stephen Colbert calls truthiness. You know, if you have a passionately held belief that the ACA leads to taxpayer-funded abortions, then you shouldn't have to prove that in a court. It's true to you, and that no entity should measure that. So that really was the substance of the case. I should add, by the way, there's a procedural wrinkle. Because Driehaus withdrew his complaint, he was not elected, he went off to Africa, this case is arguably moot. In other words, there may not be standing for Susan B. Anthony to even be in court. So the two issues the court has to decide are possibly they answer this big First Amendment question about whether you have a right to lie in elections, but there's another question about whether they were harmed enough to even walk into the court in the first place.
Right to lie. And I knew all those Americans died in the Revolutionary War for something, some higher principle, some basic freedom. Now I know what it was. By the way, naming your anti-abortion group the Susan B. Anthony List after a women's rights icon, does that count as lying under the law?
That was my first line of my piece, that is in itself an act of truthiness, because there's some very serious historical debate as to their claim that Susan B. Anthony was the first pro-life. advocate.
The fake Stephen Colbert called it truthiness. We'll see what the real Stephen Colbert calls it sometime next year. All right, the Michigan affirmative action case. The 6-2 Supreme Court majority. Elena Kagan recused herself because she was part of the administration's case on this. The 6-2 majority seemed to think the case wasn't about affirmative action at all. It was about the rights of the Supreme Court itself versus the rights of the people in each state. How did they put that in the majority decision?
Well, Anthony Kennedy is very clear. He says this case is not about how the debate about racial preferences should be resolved. He writes, it is about who may resolve it. And there is no authority in the Constitution or in this court's precedent for the judiciary to set aside Michigan laws. So basically what he's saying is, look, let's stipulate affirmative action is allowed. States that want to have it can have it. 2003, the Supreme Court upholds affirmative action in Michigan, and it's not an accident that this case comes out of Michigan. So states that want it can have it, and the court reaffirmed that last year in a Texas case. The question is, the states that don't want to have it, like Michigan, which passes a ballot initiative in 2006, saying we are going to ban the consideration of race or gender or ethnicity in college considerations and other considerations, if a state initiative says that, does the state get to decide that? So it's a flip of the question of, is affirmative action constitutional? The court says it is, but is it mandated? That's the question before the court.
But then what they say is, and the way I was promoting this segment was, the Supreme Court says to white America, hey, white America, affirmative action's up to you. Go take a poll. And so what they've really said is that any white majority in a mostly white state that wants to pass a referendum to lock in today's economic advantage over people of color, then the Supreme Court will be very restrained about getting in their way, as long as they can argue that the policy that locks in white privilege is race neutral on paper. Is that too harsh?
No, I think it's right. I think that undergirding this very, very lofty discussion, and it's complicated how it breaks down. Anthony Kennedy, Alito, and Roberts are the only three people. We don't have a clear majority for this reasoning, but those three justices have this very, very lofty language about the rights of citizens to speak and to decide important things, right? So it's all portrayed as people have to be able to debate these issues in the public realm and to enact these laws. The reason he gets a majority is because Scalia and Thomas would go much further. They want to strike down all of this race-conscious admission stuff. And then Breyer, surprisingly, the liberal Stephen Breyer, also signs on with the basic idea that Michigan can do what it did. But you're quite right that the language of the three is very much about people have to be able to enact their policy preferences, and undergirding this, what's really interesting is this fascinating discussion about who gets to talk about race and how do we talk about race. And, of course, a lot of attention goes to Sonia Sotomayor, who after 4.5 years on the bench writes this blistering 58-page dissent.
58-page.
That more or less says what you just said, but in extremely personal, passionate terms, talking about how majorities don't get to rejigger political processes in order to lock out minorities, and what it means to be a minority, always sort of being asked whether you belong and where you're from. And it's a very, very, very interesting pushback on the rhetoric that Chief Justice John Roberts used. You may recall that when they decided the Seattle Schools Affirmative Action case, the Chief Justice had very famously said in that case, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And she, in her dissent, absolutely annihilates that argument. And she says, if I may quote, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race and to apply the Constitution with eyes open to the unfortunate effects of centuries of racial discrimination. So she doesn't say we're going to just stop discriminating on the basis of race. We have to talk about what's going on.
And since they don't allow same-day audio releases to be used on the media, we can't play Sonia Sotomayor from that emotional statement from the bench. But she was on this show not that long ago, and I asked her about entering Princeton as a freshman years ago as kind of an affirmative action admit, and she said this.
Coming into Princeton, the school nurse asked me, about why, had I been considered a more likely probability to get to Princeton than the girls who were number one or number two in the school. In retrospect, in hindsight, with the wisdom of adulthood, I would have been able to tell her, because they don't work every weekend the way I do, because they're not student leaders in the way I am, and because I have shown more drive and initiative in doing more activities than they do. But I didn't have enough knowledge at that time to give that answer. And I use a line in the book that says, it gave us, those who didn't even know that a race was being run in life, a chance to come to the start of the race. And that what the answer for me would be now, it's really not how the door of opportunity opened. It's what I do with that door once I get in. And I've tried to live in a way that proves that it's not just sheer numbers that get you into school, that the complex is more complicated than that. It's the whole person. And that's what's missing in this conversation.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor on this show last year. And when she talks about it as a race, it recalls President Lyndon Johnson when he initiated some of the first affirmative action federal policies in the United States after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, going completely to the opposite argument of Chief Justice Roberts, too, that the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Not so, LBJ. Listen.
You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bringing up to the starting line of a race, and then say, you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair.
LBJ, as president, once upon a time, as we talk about the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision and the two other cases that it heard yesterday with Dahlia Lithwick from Slate. White people, do you want this power? Do you want to be able to, you know, because just about every state in America is still majority white. So you white people can band together and just say, let's have a caucus on this, because the referendum is an okay now way to decide on affirmative action, according to the Supreme Court. Do you want this power, white people? 212-433-WNYC or anybody else who wants to call in, 433-9692. Ciro in Garfield, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Brian. My question is, if referendums are the key, could this lead us on a slippery slope for states like Texas and Wisconsin and other states to have referendums to secede from the union and be upheld by the Supreme Court, that the states have the right to do these things?
Great question. Dahlia Lithwick?
Well, certainly the court is saying that in this particular case, I want to be clear, the court isn't saying we can decide every single issue of public policy by way of referendum. But I think that the court is giving an enormous bolstering vote to the sort of inherent moral and legal authority of electorate-driven referenda.
Right.
And I think that the states that have already banned affirmative action, Arizona, Nebraska, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, Washington State, California, and Florida, those states now have decided the issue that was decided by the court. So what you're going to see, without a doubt, is that other states are going to have anti-affirmative action initiatives because the court has just put his imprimatur on it.
Ciro, thank you. And to be clear, there is a point past which a majority referendum vote could not go under the 14th Amendment, right? If they're drawing this line at discrimination is discrimination, then if they wanted to reinstitute Jim Crow somewhere, let's say, the Supreme Court, as currently constituted, would probably not uphold that. I think the slippery slope really becomes effective when there are subtle ways of doing that. So it's not phrased as discrimination against people of color or against anybody overtly, but in a way that kind of locks in an economic advantage or some other advantage that exists. And I don't know if they can find the words to that for that beyond the case, the particular cases of affirmative action. But that's the question, I think, when we get into the slippery slope argument, isn't it?
Well, and what you're describing is the actual doctrine that was under scrutiny yesterday. It's called the political process doctrine, and this arises from cases in the 1960s and 1980s where the court held that when states by referendum lock in clearly racist policies, in this case it had to do with housing and busing, that violates the Equal Protection Clause. So
right.
It's exactly what you're saying.
Right.
And the court basically said, we're not overruling those cases, they just don't apply. But in effect, they gutted the political process doctrine.
Bill in Highland Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bill.
Thanks, Brian, for taking my call. The point I wanted to make was that my current understanding of the demographics of the country are that the white majority is only going to exist for a relatively short period. The estimates I've heard are in 2042, we actually revert to a white minority. And so I think that that should inform the policy discussions for the next 28 years, because whatever we put in place now will be in place when white people are, in fact, in the minority and will, I assume, want to have the kind of protections that people of color would like to have right now.
What a great point. And aren't there already some universities, and this was a University of Michigan case, but aren't there some universities, Dahlia, where there is already, in effect, affirmative action for white people so that Asian applicants don't become so dominant in any class, and they're protecting some sort of informally designated white seats for the
right.
sake of diversity, and male seats, by the way, as women become the more successful applicants on quote-unquote merit.
Right. This is exactly what happened in California that passed a similar referendum and the court didn't take it on. And what you saw was that all these, quote, white seats simply went to Asian students, but that the numbers of Latino students and black students plummeted, and which is what we've seen in Michigan just since the passing of the referendum. So one of the real problems in the way we talk about affirmative action, and we have to blame the court for this, is that the constitutional rationale for affirmative action that the court has signed off on is that we need to promote diversity in the classroom. That's the only rationale. The rationale that we want to advantage poor or minority students is not constitutionally permissible. And so then what happens is that the real problem is the plummeting numbers of certain minorities, poor students. That can't be addressed by these programs. And that's so in other words, we've set up what we like to see as a sort of colorblind aspirational model of affirmative action is good because it brings diversity to the classroom, but we can't actually remedy the problem that affirmative action set out to remedy.
Frank in Newton wants to push back on my framing of this as whites go take a vote. Frank, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Brian, it really is. You're using a racial issue by discussing whites taking a vote. All right, there are whites who do agree with affirmative action. There are blacks. There are Hispanics who disagree with affirmative action.
Not many.
I really do think you lower the conversation when you discuss this in that format. The fact of the matter is, it is a court ruling. If you're going to not discriminate, you don't discriminate in all areas. And, you know, I think the emotion involved here, Sonia Sotomayor, it's wonderful that she spoke out the way she did. The fact of the matter is, most of it was driven by emotion, not by legal precedent. And, it's a sadness when that happens because it then weakens the court itself. They should be not discussing feelings. They should be discussing law.
Another woman professional being ruled by emotions in her job. It's too bad.
Well, you're saying that. I'm not saying that. I said the court. I didn't say another woman professional. I said the court should be driven by legal precedent, not by
right.
emotion.
Well, we disagree, Frank, is that I think that where you're coming from is the most unsophisticated understanding possible of equality. To just say, as President Johnson, you know, said the opposite of when he instituted that first federal affirmative action program, to just say everything's equal, go ahead, compete on the quality of merit, don't take anything that led up to this point into account, or to say that this doesn't come down to race when you look at the polls, when you look at the different perceptions that on average the majorities of white people versus black people versus Hispanic people versus Asian people have, which really break down by race, that it
My grandfather came to this country from Ireland, all right? He couldn't get into Harvard. He couldn't get into Yale. He got into a local university, usually local college, all right? And he worked his way up, and he became very successful. No one gave him a hand up. He figured out that this was the system. He was going to figure out how to get through the system and make it work.
Right.
I mean, and the fact that you consider my unsophisticated, I helped back from Martin Luther King days. I helped a group of young black young men. All right, one of them got all the way through Williams College. All right, so I mean, I'm not unsophisticated in this. This is a legal precedent we have to take. If you're going to discriminate by having affirmative action, it's discrimination. If you want to do away with discrimination, all right, you have to do away with discrimination. And the young man just before talked about the 2040. Right, when the balance is going to change.
Right.
We have to stop this nonsense.
Frank, I appreciate the dialogue. Dahlia, go ahead.
No, I just want to make two quick points. One is I think it massively disserves Sotomayor's work in her dissent to say it was just personal and emotional. It, to the extent that I said that happened, it happened, but I think it's worth – this is an absolutely crystal clear legal discussion of the political process doctrine and why it applies and why equal protection applies. So I think it's a little bit unfair to sort of suggest that she's just emoting. But beyond that, I just want to say that what Frank is reflecting is exactly what the Chief Justice and Justice Scalia reflect in their opinions in this case, which is when someone says to them, as Sotomayor does, you're just trying to close your eyes and wish race away, it rankles. And both the chief and Scalia smack back hard at Sotomayor for exactly the reasons Frank is invoking. They don't want to be called racist. They don't want to be called white guys who don't care. And what this tells me is that the sort of majority of the Supreme Court that takes the posture that, you know what, the way to get past race is to get past race, or the way they said in last year's voting rights case, the era of race in America is over, that when that is met with very, very, very heartfelt responses and I would say evidence-based responses that, oh, my God, the era of race in America is not over, it is as pervasive and really devastating as it's always been, to be accused of being a racist is to end the conversation.
And so the University of Michigan as a public institution may not, under this ruling, even take race into account as one factor in trying to build a diverse class. Last question, does this also apply to private universities? Or can they engage in, you know, diverse class building in the ways that they have before? Does this only affect the government, the public sector, the state universities?
Yeah, the referendum was with regard to public institutions. And I should also add that I think you're going to find that admissions offices at private institutions find a way to do this. But what it does mean, and this is critical and it's useful to end on this note, is that, as Sonia Sotomayor wrote, if your dad is a white legacy at Michigan and you don't get in, you can appeal through a whole bunch of channels. If you're an African American at Michigan and you don't get in, your only choice is to amend the Constitution. That's political process doctrine, and that's what she says is unfair.
Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.